Okay. Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk. As Bernice said, I kind of do a little more one-on-one than I do actually, you know, group discussions and that kind of thing. And that's kind of what I'll kind of break the speed limit to get to talk to a Jehovah's Witness or a Muslim or an evangelical. And the funny thing about that is that I've discovered that whether I'm talking to a J-Dub or an evangelical or a Muslim, I use the same concepts, I use the same verses, I use the same applications. I reach for them all the same because they're pretty well all bitten by the same disease. And it's the disease of religion, and it shows up in many different colors, but it leaves them in the same dire consequences. And one of the things that happens with this gospel of grace is that you find the eye of the storm. And you find yourself, there could be a maelstrom surrounding you and torrential winds and driving rains, and somehow in the deepest central part of your heart, there is a calm that is, it's hard to explain. And Paul the Apostle found that. I'm not sure that many of the other guys did. They probably all died kicking and screaming, but Paul the Apostle had a place of peace and comfort because of his concepts and the way that he relates that to us. Had a little debate with a lady this afternoon on a job site, and she was messianic, and so she just made a statement to me today that the Torah has never been done away with. It's never been abolished. He came to fulfill the Torah, but it's never been done away with. And I said, what about the concepts of Paul when he said that the handwriting of ordinances that was contrary to us? I said, have you ever looked at the Torah as being contrary to us? And she said, not really. Well, that was the concept of Paul, that the Torah was contrary to us and that Christ took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. And then there is verily a disannulling of the commandments having gone before for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. There was a disannulling of the commandments. And she said, well, what happened back then is that God took the laws that were written on tables of stone and he just transferred it over and engraved them on the fleshly tables of our hearts. So we're still under the law, but we've got a little more grace to keep it. And then I start by saying, that's a worse problem. Because you used to have to go to the tables of stone to read it, but now it's in your heart, and all you've got to do is just internalize, and you've got a built-in self-condemning judgmental system engraved in your heart. And then I made a statement today that there was only one heart, and I will research this out, but it kind of came to me in a flush of a moment, and that there's only one heart that had the tables of stone that had the law engraved on it, and that was the heart that was pierced by a Roman sword when it hung on a cross. And she talked about generational curses, and I said, well, it's funny how when you do one-on-one, it's an amazing dialogue that that you just enter into. So she said, yeah, I'm kind of concerned about generational curses. And I said, well, the last thing that was cursed was Christ on the cross. That was the very last thing that ever got cursed. And then I quoted a verse that says, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangeth upon a tree. Cursed is everyone that hangeth upon... So I said, I asked her the question, how many do you think hung on the tree that day? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, maybe everyone. Maybe everyone. The last thing that God cursed was his son on the cross, and he cursed every human being that was placed in him. Paul says, we thus judge that since one died for all were dead. There were no survivors at the cross. Everybody died. She never heard anything even close to that before. So I said, if there was a law, it would have to be warbled over dead people that are not concerned about it. We're all dead. There's nothing left to judge. God threw the gavel down, sat in the big easy chair, and allows us to climb up in his lap where we can call him Abba Father. Doesn't that sound like fun?
Yes.
That is so much fun. And just a week prior to, we have some rental properties around town. One's about, it's about two blocks away from the University of Calgary. We have students flying in from all over the world. They're on the phone with us. They want to live off residence. So we've got an off residence campus, and I'm the guy that shows the rooms. I'm the property manager. My wife is the landlord, but we don't tell them of our connection. So we play good cop, bad cop, and it kind of works better that way. She's the bad cop, and I'm the good cop. But it's amazing the people that come from around the world and the stories that they have. So a couple of weeks ago, young Muslim lady raised in Iran, probably 25, 28 years of age, whatever. And I extended my hand to welcome her to Canada, and she pulled back and said, No. We do not shake hands with males. I said, well, that's okay. That's no problem. Can't get offended. I mean, what? Am I going to get offended? I've had, you know, people refuse to shake hands with me for more reasons than that. Hers was just a cultural thing. But we started into a conversation, and she said, well, we believe in Jesus. And I said, well, I want you to know that your Quran tells you to listen to the people of the gospel because they won't steer you wrong. Well, I am a person of the gospel, and I won't steer you wrong. And I just want to ask you a few questions. And she said, okay. I said, do you believe that Jesus was virgin born? Yes. And Mary is mentioned in the Quran? Yes. And the name of Jesus is mentioned 23 times in the Quran? Yes. And you believe that he was virgin born? Yes. But you have a problem. You don't have a problem with the miracles or the 12 or the people he walked with. You got no problem with. She said, no, we believe that he was a great prophet, a great teacher, a great prophet. We just do not believe that he was the son of God. God, Allah doesn't have any sons. I said, well, do you believe that he died on the cross? She said, no. She said, there is a verse in the Quran that tells us that he did not die on the cross, but that it was an imposter. So then I started into a little dialogue. When did this imposter stand in? When? She said, what do you mean? I said, if there was a change of characters, when did the real Messiah step aside, the real Jesus step aside, and the imposter step in? How would it be in the garden maybe when he was surrounded by the 12 and got arrested by the soldiers and led away? And they all fled off because they were so scared. Do you think the imposter maybe stood in then when the 12 recognized that he was their best friend? Or could it have been maybe at the whipping post? Could the imposter have stood in and take the whipping for the real, genuine Messiah? Yeah, nobody's ever told us, you know, when the imposter came. We just know that it was only made to look like Jesus died, but it really wasn't, because the real Jesus didn't die on a cross. And I said, have you ever read the Gospels? She said, no, not really. And I said, do you know when that person was hanging on a cross, looking down, do you know who was looking up at him? She said, no. I said, it was his mother, Mary, and his best friend, John. Do you think if the imposter had showed up then, maybe Mary would have recognized that he's not the real deal? And how about 3 days later, she shows up with 100 pounds of embalming fluid to embalm the body of an imposter? Really? You think she doesn't know who her son is? And I just looked at her and I said, you Muslim folks need to stop asking if he died and start asking why he died. It was such a fun conversation. And then I started to expound to her the sweetness of this Jesus and who he was. And how that day, 2,000 years ago, that he reached out his arms and drew her, burqa and all, straight into his heart and paid for her lock, stock, and barrel and transferred instantaneously down through the hallways into the future the same holiness that was his own. And that she stands before me today, clothed in the righteousness of an almighty God. And God does have sons and daughters. And I said, you are in his family. It was so much fun to say that. Evangelicals can't say that. Southern Baptists can't say that. Wesleyans can't say that. J-Dubs, Mormons, who can say that? Do you have any idea how waterproof this boat is getting that we are in and the people that will be climbing on board? And this is an awakening time that we're really, I hate to say the word time, but I am so glad that 17 years ago, 18, whatever it was, I walked into a little room and I met Mike for the first time. And I was in a place of absolute hell. Anybody in this room ever been to hell? I was walking through the hallways of hell. And I met an angel that carried me to a place and talked to me. And I remember he looked at me and says, you know, keep your eyes wide open and don't miss a step. That's great spiritual advice, isn't it? But what he said rung true, and I started doing that. And I started going through the Bible from cover to cover and relaying a whole foundation, which leads me to where I am today in a place of comfort. Place of comfort. So I've been doing a little bit of research, and I thought that I would maybe just take a few minutes and expound on Luke chapter 16. I preached this sermon several years ago, and the title was There Is a Hell. And I preached it from my old evangelical perspective. And can I just read you a little bit so that you can get a picture of this? This is Luke 16. It begins at verse 19. There was a certain rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. If you're going to be debating evangelicals or talking to Baptists or full gospel or Pentecostals, we need to have a different backdrop to lay this in. We need to have a more accurate way to describe Luke chapter 16, because speaking from my past evangelical experience, this was my cardinal verse to go to. And this is where I took my text from on that fateful morning when I delivered that awful sermon. I preached hell so hot that day that when I shut the service down and stood at the doorway to shake hands with the folks that were walking by, I had several skulk by, wouldn't offer a hand, couldn't look me in the face. Like they loathed, and I'm thinking, because I laid it on them and I said, you sit here in this congregation listening to the words that I'm speaking, and you go home and your neighbor lives right next door and you'll see him across the fence on Monday morning and you don't have the gall to tell him how to keep his soul from going to hell. I said, shame on you, shame on all of you. And they skulked out of there like a bunch of wounded sheep. And so they should have. Was I right in doing that? And it begs me to go back to several of the old pastors that I used to kind of, you know, cavort with and hang around with. And they would say, bless God, in the last 50 years, I haven't changed anything about my doctrine. I'm still preaching the same. And I'm thinking, how sad is that? That in 50 years, you haven't learned anything. You're still the same old retard you were way back then. That's got to be a regressive problem, isn't it? If we're not learning, if we're not growing, we're shrinking. Let's get on with the text here just a little bit. So this rich man fared sumptuously every day. He made $1,000 a day if he never got out of bed. No problem. And there was a certain beggar, here's the contrast, named Lazarus, which was laid at his gate full of sores. And desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table, moreover the dogs came and licked his. It's a pretty pathetic picture, isn't it? And it came to pass that the beggar died. So here we've got the beggar dying. And I see the beggar's death as being a cocoon that's just birthing into a butterfly. But when the rich man dies, it's more like a butterfly that's crawling back into a cocoon. I think what I've got here in this text, I look at it as more of an allegory, more of a teaching, more of a parable. You can go on to the parables that are in prior chapters, and I think this kind of follows suit with that. So it tells us then that the rich man licked his sores, the beggar died, and was carried by the angels. It's strange because this is the only place that I know of that this was the destination of somebody who died. Abraham's bosom. The angels carried him into Abraham's bosom, which lends, I think, to a stronger understanding that it's an allegory. How does this man get into a dead man's stomach if we're taking this literally? Doesn't happen. So he's talking about this. This is Jesus talking about the beggar dying, being carried by angels into a place of comfort. There was a a transformation that happened with the beggar, that he was taken from torment to comfort. Does that ring with anybody in the room tonight? Taken from torment to comfort. Now, when the rich man died, he was taken from comfort to torment. So this is really a dialogue about how you get from one place to another, how you get from torment to comfort and comfort to torment. And I think a lot of us in this room have probably experienced both. Right now, I'm enjoying a wonderful place of comfort, and it's really based on the gospel. I didn't know that I could ever get here, because now, as I mentioned before, the storm can blow, the winds and the rain, but there's still something deeply settled down inside. Now, watch how the dialogue unfolds here. It says, and in hell, the rich man, he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, and sees Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cries and says, Father, have mercy on me. So the first thing he asked for was mercy. The second thing he asked for was that he would send Lazarus, who could dip his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, son. So obviously this man was maybe Hebrew. In this particular story. So he said, son, remember that you in your lifetime received good things and Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. So then the rich man gets a missionary call, and Abraham mentions in verse 26, between me and you, there's a great gulf that is fixed. Now, I kind of have an idea that the great gulf that was fixed back then got fixed. That it's a possibility for people to go from a place of torment into a place of comfort. And it happens with really a revelation of who Jesus Christ and the finished work of the cross is all about. So it says, verse 27, then he said, I pray thee therefore, Father, that you would send him to my father's house, for I have five brethren, and he may testify to them. So what he's asking is, that Lazarus would be raised from the dead, back to life, goes to the father's house, has a call, a burden, a missionary call to talk to his five brothers to keep them from coming to this awful place of torment. And then Abraham says a strange thing. It's so strange. This is one time when Abraham really endorses Moses. And I'm sure that Moses really endorsed Abraham. There's no doubt about that. There is no problem with law and grace when you understand the purpose of both. I love law. I love the Ten Commandments. I love the laws of God. But watch what Abraham says. He says, to keep my five brothers from coming to this awful place of torment. Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. What a statement. Moses has long since been dead as well when this story is coming out. So he says, let them hear Moses and the prophets. And then the rich man says, they'll be more persuaded if somebody rises from... Are you getting a picture of what this whole Luke 16 is about? They'll be more persuaded if they can be talked to by somebody that's just come back from the dead. And Abraham says, if they won't hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded the one rose from the dead, which is the disease of the North American church in a nutshell. Why is it that they can't get the message of the one who rose from the dead? It's because they don't really understand the message of the law and the prophets. You got to go back and get on the bus. You got to let Moses drive you to the foot of the cross. You got to see that bus get emptied. You got to see everything that the law was given purpose to do. For instance, it tells us that that the law came that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world become guilty before God. That the law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. When you understand the purpose of the law and you understand the prophecies of the prophets, I tuned into Mike's Daniel's 70th week just days ago. And somebody should have said this a long time ago, right? How did we ever get sold a bill of goods that there's at least a 2,000-year gap between week 69 and week 70? No gap. There's no gap. It's all completed and fulfilled at the cross. Daniel is a past tense. The book of Revelation is a past tense. It's all historical. As I've mentioned, I think the last time I spoke to you, that Revelation is, I think it's 404 verses and 278 of them are Old Testament repeats. You can find the writers of the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Old Testament writings, which is really what the book of Revelation is. It's just a fresh way to look at an old story. And Christ took all that wrath in his own body on the cross. So the point that I'm saying is that when we get the message of the law and the prophets, then we understand the power of the one that did rise from, not Lazarus, of course, but the real one that rose from the dead. We get the full message of the understanding of the resurrection of Christ. And then we see ourselves in righteousness as where the law is supposed to bring us to the foot of the cross. And we find our righteousness in the person of Christ. Now, I've been doing a little bit of research, and I'm going to close in just a few minutes time, but I want to give you a little excerpt tonight of what I've been spending some of my late evenings and early mornings learning. I kind of wanted to know where the great North American awakening came from. And so I went back into an old sermon that I resurrected years ago. I didn't preach it, but I quoted from it. Way back in Bible college day, it was when I really wanted to warm one up. I love talking about hell. Love scaring people to death. I had a little bit of a Stephen King mentality in me, and I tried to feed that a bit. So years ago, I went back and I researched the Jonathan Edwards sermon of 1741, and he entitled it "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Some of you are probably familiar with that. I'm going to read you a few captions from that, and I want to say at the outset that I have a lot of respect for Jonathan Edwards. He's living in a day 280 years ago where the lanterns were still fueled by the blubber from whales that were caught offshore. There's no internal combustion engine. There's no petroleum industry. Man has certainly not walked on the moon. We're talking 120 years before the Great Civil War. We're talking 130 years before Abraham Lincoln was born. 280 years ago, Jonathan Edwards stood in 1741 in Elgin, Connecticut, and delivered that sermon to his own congregation. Can I just go on to say that the conclusions that came out of the ministries back in Connecticut and Massachusetts, which were still fresh off the Salem witch hunts, witchcraft everywhere, people were spooked to death, and I did a little research on the little village that Jonathan Edwards pastored in, and in the year 2010 there was still only 40,000 people that lived there, approximately 44,000, I think, or I'm going by memory. Not a very big place. So go back 280 years ago, you got a few scattered farmers, you know, maybe some dairy, maybe a little few crops, some carrots, and you got some corn in the field, and you got some housewives with aprons and making bread on an old wood stove, and putting a little more whale blubber in the lantern for light at night. And Jonathan Edwards, who studies 13 hours a day, is off in a room by himself trying to get another message on hell for his congregation for Sunday because he's afraid the last one might just wear. Can I read you some of the excerpts here? I'm going to try to pull this up. It may take me just a second. In part of it, he said, the bow of God's wrath is bent and the arrow made ready. Now, I can't say it or read it or enunciate it like he did, but he was a soft-spoken man with distinct enunciation. He might read it something like, the bow of God's wrath is, perhaps, I don't know that it would, but anyway. The bow of God's wrath is bent and the arrow made ready on the string, and justice bends the arrow at your heart and strains the bow. And it is nothing but the mere pleasure of God and that of an angry God, without any promise or obligation at all, that keeps the arrow one moment from being made drunk with your blood. Modern application is, God is a sniper and he's got a 50 cal with the crosshairs right between your eyes. It's a hair trigger, the hammer is cocked, and he is angry and fed up and frustrated with you. And the only thing that keeps that hair trigger from squeezing, releasing that hammer against a primer cap, igniting gunpowder, and sending a 50 caliber ball down a rifled barrel at 3,600 feet per second and striking you right between the eyes and putting you in the hallways of hell is a tiny little bit of mercy that you better be thankful for. There's a picture for you. Okay, here's another excerpt from that same sermon. the God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you. Can I read that again? The God that holds you over the pit. We should have been talking about this a long time ago. Because you want to know why? I am quoting to you, I am reading to you one of the sermons that came down through Calvinism that has been credited to one of the greatest reasons for what they call the Great Awakening that went down through the New England seacoast. They call this the Great Awakening. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you. He had no problem looking at his congregation and said, God abhors you. And is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. Do you want to know what the response was from messages like that coming from a podium? We have to be so careful. We have to be so careful and treat people as precious commodity when we're talking to them. Those kinds of messages left Joseph Howley the second. He was a lieutenant. Left him home on a Sunday morning. He didn't go to church at this particular time. He stayed in bed. With a sharp knife, he found his jugular vein and thrust that in and cut his own throat. And when they found his body, they described it as giving into religious despair. I guess so. And when Jonathan Edwards visited around the communities and talked to people, he wrote himself that there were multitudes that were contemplating and driven towards thinking about suicide. That's where that kind of message will put you. Why did Jonathan Edwards stand there and say that? He was doing the very best he could. He was being honest with his congregation. He really didn't want to see them lost, but he had no idea. And the Great Awakening was started by men like him and Whitfield that had no idea what the law and the prophets were saying, so they couldn't receive the full power of the resurrected one that came to make them as righteous as he is. And there were shrieks, screams and cries and convulsions, and some went into a trance for 24 hours under fear as a response to listening to messages like that. When we walk into a room like this tonight and we can hear the sweet grace of a holy God that's transferred that to us, wow, we've got something to say. Can you see why I need to talk to evangelicals? Why I need to meet with Baptist folks? Why I need to talk with Jehovah's Witnesses and Muslims? We've got something to say. We have something to say. Wow. Thank you very much for your time. And Mike, I'm really looking forward to Romans. Bless you.